This is the Green Room behind the scenes at the National News Show of Texas, the Texas Standard. Now, if you follow the news, you no doubt know the name Bill Moyers, the respected public television journalist. What you may not know about is a personal struggle involving his son, William Cope Moyers. These days, William Cope Moyers talks and writes rather candidly about what happened.
My father and I relapsed from our chronic illnesses at almost the same moment in 1994. No doctor, family member, colleague, or insurance company judged my father when he was rushed to the hospital for open-heart surgery. Get well is all that everyone wished. Everybody questioned my relapse. After 3 years of sobriety, I'd fallen off the wagon, as people who don't understand or want to say when addiction relapse flares. Even my father likened it to a crash.
That is the voice of author and former CNN journalist William Cope Moyers. His father is best known to most of our listeners as Bill Moyers, the longtime journalist and TV news commentator who also served as special assistant to President Lyndon Johnson. He joins us as well here in the studio along with William's mother, Judith, executive editor of Moyers & Company and CEO of Public Affairs Television. Thank you all for coming in. We certainly do appreciate it. When did you first realize that you had a drinking problem?
Well, I didn't realize it for a long time, David. I started smoking marijuana at the age of 15, experimenting like a lot of teenagers do, and I immediately began to progress down that slippery slope of what I would later come to realize was an addiction to alcohol and other drugs. But it was probably only in 1988, when I was a newspaper reporter in New York, about a year before I hit bottom the first time, that I remember waking up one day and thinking, if I have a problem, I'm probably going to need to ask for help. But of course, addiction is a disease of denial, not just to the person who has it, but to everyone around that person, particularly when somebody like me functions like I did. And so I managed to sort of dodge and dart and cover up my tracks and avoid the direct consequences most of the time. And if it had not been for my mother confronting me and confronting my illness on a street corner in Harlem on that hot day in 1989, I'm not sure that I would have been able to start that road of recovery that is so integral to that day-to-time experience.
Judith Moyers, your mother's right here with us. You remember that day?
Oh, yeah.
What had happened? What was it that triggered your response?
I'll never forget it. Cope's wife had called and said that she didn't know where he was and she hadn't heard from him, which was very unusual because he was a newspaper reporter and he was often gone overnight doing all kinds of investigative work, but always would call her. And she said, I'm very worried because I haven't heard from him in 48 hours. And so Bill was out of town, but I called our lawyer and I said, could you check the hospitals and the police on Long Island? And he called me back after a while. He said, he's not been arrested and he's not in a hospital. And let's go look for him. And we've discovered that he was somewhere in Harlem. And we actually found his car. And we, at the end of the day, I saw him. And he came out and spoke to me. And I said, I think you're sick and you need to come home with me now. And he said, I won't do that, but I'll go home. And he then did a very heroic thing. I think he did go home, spoke with his wife, and the next day checked himself into a hospital.
Bill Moyers, as a public figure, obviously you've got to be protective of your son. You know people are going to be looking at you and judging your family. When did you find out about this, and how did that affect you?
Well, I was a journalist at the time, and am a journalist today, and I had a somewhat public identity, but I never thought about that. I thought, what's happening to our son? Is he going to survive? Is he going to make this? And we had a large coterie of colleagues, Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite, both of whom had been through Austin. And just a number of colleagues called up and said, if there's anything we can do, help. I mean, immediately there was a supportive, collegial, professional community. I mean, that was very helpful. But I was scared, like any father who's never imagined that one of his children could be in danger of death from addiction. I was scared we were going to lose him. And I felt immediate relief when he checked himself into a hospital in New York and was going to be there for at least 30 days. I knew nothing was likely to happen to him then. But it was a story that kept unfolding with one dramatic chapter of improvement and then threat again. And we learned to live with it, but it was never easy.
If we hadn't had professional help ourselves, I don't know how we would have reacted. We were in a real state of shock about this wonderful son of ours who'd never given us any real trouble. He was such a high achiever in every way. We did not see symptoms until just shortly before he crashed.
You know, what this has echoes of the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. You know, at the time when he died, a lot of folks in the media asking questions like, how could this happen? I mean, he's a good man. He's an upstanding character. Everyone said that on screen and off, he was a remarkable person. And, you know, for the sake of his children, why couldn't he rise above it? All these sorts of issues. That's sort of why you wrote the piece that you were reciting just a little bit earlier.
Sure, because I could relate to it, and so could my family. People were shocked when Hoffman died. People were shocked when Moyers relapsed. Fortunately, I did not have the ultimate ending that he had. I survived in part because I had the continued support of my family, my employer, my community. People didn't give up on me, even though I'd given up on myself. Look, addiction is a chronic illness, and like chronic illnesses, it can't be cured, but it can be treated. People, whether they're suffering from diabetes or hypertension or asthma, they want to recover as well. It's just that when somebody relapses with the disease of addiction, it tends to be rather ugly and a shock, because people want to believe that it's done, that it can't happen again. And then it happened to me, like it happens to a lot of people. And relapse is, for some people, part of the experience. I learned a lot from relapses, but fortunately, I survived them to learn a lot. Recovery is possible. I've been living it for 20 years now, but I still have to take care of myself day after day. I take responsibility for ingesting marijuana and drinking legally alcohol at the age of 18, but what it did to me had an effect that it doesn't have except on about 1 in 10 people, and that has to do with the intricacies of the wiring in the brain and a lot of other dynamics within the body.
Well, I think this gets to a larger sort of question about that seems to be talked a lot about in this context, the question of responsibility. Is it unreasonable to hold the alcoholic accountable for drinking, the addict popping pills?
It's absolutely reasonable to hold them accountable. And in fact, if you don't hold them accountable, they'll keep doing it. Until I was held accountable by my family, my employer, and my community, I was incapable on my own of understanding the implications, not just of my drinking and drugging, but the opportunities that came from not drinking and drugging. It was that being held accountable that kept me grounded in the reality that I needed to get well. In the same way the diabetic has to take her insulin, or the asthmatic has to take their medication for that, I needed to take my medicine. One of the ways we can best hold people accountable is by making sure that if they break the law, they serve the time. But it's folly in Texas or in this country to hold people accountable if we're not also going to give them the opportunity to get treatment for what ails them, in this case, addiction.
You talk about the folly of incarceration without treatment. What other policy solutions need to be considered?
We've made huge strides in this country. Since I came to Austin in 1998 and lobbied at the legislature here about making sure that laws embrace the reality that treatment is an effective policy. And the biggest stride I think we've made over those decades since 1998 has been including addiction in the Affordable Care Act. Now, whatever you think about the Affordable Care Act, it is the law. And in that law is coverage for addiction treatment. That's a big step. Ditto insurance companies. Up until a couple of years ago, insurance companies willfully discriminated against addicts and alcoholics and their families. It was George Bush in the fall of 2008 that signed legislation into law that we've been lobbying for years to get insurance companies to stop discriminating. And it was the Obama administration that implemented the regulations in that law that now treat addiction like other chronic illnesses. That's a major step in the right direction. But to be candid with you, the biggest step we need to make, not just in policy, but in public perception, is to get people to start to stand up and talk about what we're talking about right now, so that people can realize that addiction doesn't discriminate, and neither should recovery.
That's William Cope Moyers and his parents, Bill and Judith Moyers, visiting us in the green room here at the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We'll talk again soon.